Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the Lemon School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. The U.S.-led international order is under strain from within and without. Authoritarian powers, such as Russia and China, are challenging the core tenets of global cooperation and conflict management. Rising states of the global south, like India, Brazil, and South Africa, are demanding reformed multilateralism in the institutions of global governance. And the US and its Western allies face a domestic surge of right-wing populism that seeks to reverse the 80-year-old open and interdependent system of international relations. At stake is democracy, a core tenet of American life and foreign policy. To discuss and consider these issues, in May 2025, the LSE Phelan U.S. Center held the conference, International Relations and Democracy in a Multipolar World. The conference brought together scholars and experts to examine how important these democratic discourses and practices are in the broader context of challenges to the U.S.-led international order and the domestic contestation over the future direction of U.S. foreign policy. The conference was convened by Phelan U.S. Center affiliates Dr. Rohan Mukherjee and Dr. Luca Tardelli of LSE's International Relations Department, and by Teresa Squatrito, also of LSE's Department of International Relations, and Matthias Koenig Achibugi of LSE's Department of Government. I spoke to Rohan Mukherjee and Teresa Squatrito about the main themes and takeaways from the conference and what it was trying to achieve.
I'm Teresa Squatrito, and I am an associate professor of international relations at the LSE. So currently my research examines issues around contestation over international institutions, where I'm looking specifically at international courts to ask why and under what conditions political elites seek to delegitimize these institutions, and specifically international criminal tribunals like the International Criminal Court. And then secondly, to then see how these institutions respond to criticism. So do they address these critiques directly? Do they try to remind leaders of their commitments? Or do they try to get tough? Or do they sometimes just decide to strategically remain silent? So those are sort of the questions that I am looking into.
My name is Rohan Mukherjee, and I teach international relations as an assistant professor at the LSE. I work on rising powers and international order. And more recently, I've been focused on the Global South in all its different forms and how it sort of responds to international order and is dealing with the current changes that are underway in the international order. I have another project that I'm working on that looks at the role of democracy in foreign policy, specifically comparing how the U.S. responded to the collapse of democracy in the Philippines in 1972 and in India in 1975, and looking at the role of what alliances do in these relationships, and the Philippines being an ally, India not. So that's just some of the work that I'm doing at the moment.
So on the 15th and 16th of May, 2025, with the support of the Phelan U.S. Center, you both convened the conference, International Relations and Democracy in a Multipolar World, here at LSE. Can you talk about why the conference was timely and what it hopes to achieve?
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and start. And so as I see it, I think it was timely for two reasons. One, a bit more that's academic in nature, and the other that's a little bit more oriented towards world events. So the first is that we generally appear to be seeing a pivotal moment in terms of world historical time, I believe, and that is around the evolution of democracy. And this is most prominently seen in two developments, I would say. The first is there appears to be a note, which has actually been documented, a notable decline of democracy in domestic governance, or in other words, the rise of authoritarianism. The second major development is that we see a rejection of and contestation over the liberal international order, which seems to be coinciding with that domestic development, but also with an additional development, which is shifts in the distribution of power at the global level. So that's the first kind of major development I think that's important. The more academic one is that for scholars of international relations, it's been nearly a century since we've been starting to seriously have the conversation about the role of democracy above the state. So in that sense, it was timely because being nearly a quarter of a century, it's kind of a good stock-taking sort of moment, which then for me, that speaks to the principal aims as I saw it. So the first is that it's about taking a stock taking. So asking questions around and trying to grasp what is the actual health of democracy in international relations? And then secondly, what might be behind the changes that we see? Is it that there's genuine and significant changes in practices and discourses? Is this driven mostly by international organizations, states, or civil society? So I think that kind of the aims correspond with what I see as the two main kinds of things that are making it a really timely conversation.
Yeah, just to echo what Teresa said, when we initially conceived of this with our colleagues, Matthias Koenig, Archie Bougi, and Luca Tardelli, we sort of thought about this kind of stock-taking exercise, right, at a moment where domestically and internationally, democracy seems to be being called into question a lot more than before, and even under attack in many cases. And so kind of thinking about what its status is as an international institutional form, as a norm, and as a domestic political organizing principle. And I think particularly important in this current setting where I think the domestic realm, people have begun sort of becoming alienated from democracy or switching their support to anti-democratic or illiberal political parties and leaders, which has significant impacts for international relations as well. And so thinking also about those connections of how do the domestic and international connect. And then globally, I think, you know, the so-called sort of liberal order was meant to be based on democratic principles and institutions, but now the rise of illiberal countries and autocracies like China and Russia has not only made it harder to sustain this international order, but also given space to many other countries in the global South to argue, often rightly, that the West thought was a democratic order was never actually that thing. And so if it wasn't, then what are we sort of heading towards as well? So there was a sort of future-oriented aspect towards the end of the conference as well, where we had a final session on where are we at, where are we going?
So you've sort of alluded to these a little bit already, but what would you say were the real main themes and takeaways coming out of the conference?
The conference was structured in six panels. There was a roundtable at the front and a roundtable at the end. The substance in terms of the academic discussions that we wanted to encourage were in the four panels in the middle, where people who were presenting were asked to write papers that were kind of a condensation of their past work and its application to the questions of the conference. And so those were sort of the panel that we had a panel on what is democracy? You know, what are the varieties of democracy around the world? Then we had one on national discourses and practices of democracy. We had one on democratic global governance in international organizations. And finally, sort of civil society, you know, global civil society and how that perceives, you know, individual public attitudes and also civil society organizations, how they think about and practice democracy. So that was sort of the four big panels. And then we had roundtables, one at the beginning sort of setting the stage and the other at the end taking stock.
So I think the first thing that I took away from the conversation as a whole is that this understanding the state of democracy in international relations or the health of democracy in international relations really is one of these things that has an eye of the beholder challenge. So some people can take, if you will, a lot of people kept saying things like, you know, it depends if you see it as a through the, you know, glass half full or the glass half empty. But I think the real challenge is that we can use different benchmarks for making those kinds of assessments. So for some people, the benchmark is let's look at what exists at the domestic level and then assess what's happening at the international based on what our kind of understandings of democracy is based on the domestic experience. Now, for others, it's some ideal vision of what democracy one, overall means, and two, what democracy in international relations or international politics should be. And for some, it's let's assess this given the past. And in that sort of genre of approaches, you also have this issue of how far back do we go? We had some people drawing analogies to ancient Greece, and then we have some people drawing analogies to, you know, the 1940s. And then some, it's 20 years ago. So it becomes this real challenge when we're not all using the same reference point. So I think in some ways, the take home is a question of, is there a way we can start to identify what is the maybe the appropriate benchmark, but if not the appropriate, how do we then become explicit about our assumptions about what that benchmark is?
At the conceptual level, I thought there was sort of my takeaway, at least, was that there's more understanding today that democracy doesn't mean one thing or signify a fixed set of attributes, that there are actually different ways of being democratic, or at least how people perceive themselves to be democratic or not, and even the extent to which they place value in something like democracy for delivering things that they care about, like jobs and public services and education and health and all of that. Often democracy struggles with that, although there is a problem here of shifting goalposts, which is the better you do, the more you expect, or more people expect from you, right? And so I think as democracies have succeeded in doing that, expectations have also grown. And then you have these sort of alternative models of autocracies like China delivering those things at scale. And so there really is a conceptual challenge here. And I think recognition of that in this setting was, I think, very valuable.
I think that one of the things that was really interesting that kind of speaks to that too was the conversations that came out about how various regimes, especially authoritarian regimes themselves, latch on and use especially democratic discourses. Now, some, of course, might have some sense of, you know, democratic values being practiced, whether it be some version of a majoritarian sort of principle of elections, of course, questioning the liberal element of that. But that indeed we can see clubs of autocrats, but as well as democracies themselves, rallying for something like democracy or values that reflect democracy, which is, one, for some, a little bit surprising. But I think at the end of the day, that still suggests that is a value that is appreciated in some way.
It was also really helpful to have people working on international organizations like Teresa herself and others who emphasize the gradual yet steady evolution of international organizations in more democratic directions. I think that that's something that often in the world that I occupy intellectually gets lost in the conversation, because Global South countries are so quick to say everything is unrepresentative, everything is inequitable, and therefore let's reform the whole thing. But in fact, if you take the longer view, I think as you were talking about quarter of a century, even longer, you start to see that there has been incremental change. Now, whether that change is sufficient or not, I think is a different question. Yes. It's not that the system has been static. And I think I learned a lot on that front. I'm thinking about both in terms of narratives, like as you were saying, how people talk about democracy and as a valued thing. Even Russia wants to create a democratic, multipolar international order, but also in actual practices, in terms of consultation, transparency, values other than the simple one country, one vote principle, I think have really come to the fore. And I think that was, for me, a big learning.
Maybe another take home for me, we kind of resonates a lot around that. But what I think was interesting is that at the end, I felt like the whole impetus behind the workshop was a little bit this sense of we're in dire straits, right? Like just because of what we're seeing happen on the global stage, some rejection of core liberal principles by very powerful actors, especially the United States, for some of us feels very disconcerting. So I guess one takeaway I took is that perhaps it's not all doom and gloom in a way. Of course, there still remains a lot of vibrant kind of rhetoric around democracy, which I think is good. And there are still some practices that we can, I think in some ways are quite robust. They may be isolated in different situations and at different times. But I think now the real question is what leads those rhetorics and practices to correspond? And ultimately, how and when might they be resilient?
I'd like to ask a follow-up question, if I may. You mentioned the United States, and I'd just be interested to hear a bit more about how the U.S. figured in some of the conversations, or if there was kind of an overall sense of thinking about the direction the U.S. might be going in at the moment.
I mean, naturally, the U.S. it overhangs all of this in some sense, because the international order that was built and sustained by the U.S. for so many decades was premised on democratic values to some extent, right? This is at least the narrative that many scholars of this order have sort of suggested. And, you know, the U.S. itself has been a liberal democracy for many years, the world's oldest democracy in the modern era. And so to that extent, I think what happens in the U.S. has a sort of demonstration effect around the world, but it also has real consequences, because when you know, aid programs are cut, when international institutions are gutted, when global cooperation is kind of significantly damaged by the chief democracy and guarantor of the international order, countries around the world have experienced negative effects, but also, you know, in some cases, positive effects. But those positive effects in the long term might have negative effects. And so in some sense, every conversation had touched on the role of the U.S. in all of this, both directly and indirectly.
So the conference happened basically, I think, the day after Trump began his tour of the Middle East, or it coincided with it. I'm not exactly sure if it was the day after or not. So I think what was interesting about that timing was that, if you recall, when he was on that tour, he basically expressed that the U.S. is no longer interested in dictating how a state governs itself, which is a significant shift in American foreign policy, which since roughly the Carter administration was really about using American soft power, if not even hard power, to help reinforce democratic principles and practices abroad. So it was in that backdrop we were having that conversation. And I think, again, that's where some of the, at least for many of us, it felt like a doom and gloom sort of moment. But then when we went through the stock taking, we were reminded of states in the global south, as well as other places in the global north, who are themselves still committed to democratic principles, whether or not that's through, say, international organizations and their programs of democracy promotion, or of states themselves or civil society that is actively promoting democracy. So I think that was kind of the context that also we saw the U.S. In this conversation.
Could you both talk about some of the highlights from some of the talks that were presented during the conference?
Sure. I mean, I have a few. I think Dr. Maria Debra's work was particularly sort of noteworthy for me, I think, because she looks at what she calls dictators' clubs, I think, which are basically regional organizations. And so in this sort of broader democratic liberal international order, or an order dominated by democracies, how do autocracies find spaces for themselves? She argues it is through regional organizations, where they can control the agenda and they can protect their regimes from what they see as the destabilizing effects of global democracy, right? So I think that was a fascinating thing. And you kind of, the paired paper to that, which I thought was really interesting, was our colleague Luca Tardelli's paper, where he provided this long durée view of U.S. foreign policy thinking, which he argues has gone initially in the 19th century from democracy protection, which is to protect the U.S. from conservative monarchies in Europe, to today sort of promoting democracy around the world. And so he talks about that transition. And so I think you can see the sort of both sides of the coin, as it were, which is, in some sense, the U.S. has become more interested, or at least until recently was more interested, in promoting democracy globally. And as other non-democratic countries became powerful, they were more interested in protecting themselves from that phenomenon. And so I think Maria's and Luca's papers were very nicely complementing each other in that sense.
I was also drawn to both of those presentations and the conversations we had around them. I was also really intrigued by the presentation by our colleague here at LSE, of Caterina Della Cora, who presented kind of the understanding of democracy, how democracy is conceptualized, or at least what sorts of rhetorics there are around democracy in the Middle East, which was, of course, timely, like for other reasons, such as the visit by President Trump. But also, it's a good reminder of, I think, you know, coming from having been part of the earlier conversations on democracy and international institutions, there's very much a kind of Western sort of global North perspective in that conversation, or there has been. So it was refreshing to get the perspective of a scholar who has spent her career on the Middle East talking about what that term means in that part of the world. But then also Rohan himself, of talking about this conversation from the perspective of the Global South. And we also had another speaker, Davison, who also gave a Global South perspective, which I think was, for me especially, quite refreshing and unique, that I really hadn't been as exposed to as much. as we see this shift in the global context, whether or not we look at the US's position or rise of states like China, I think in some ways we need to pay better attention to the states in the global South, but also to hear them better in what they're saying when they speak about democracy. Because clearly the West or the US doesn't own that concept, right? And other places may have some really good ideas about how that can be lived and realized.
And just on the question of representation, I mean, I thought, again, we seem to only focus on our own colleagues, but Professor Karen Smith's paper, I think it was quite almost shocking to me because it was one of those things that makes you wake up and realize how stark the inequalities are in the system when it comes to gender. And she presented a statistic that said only 8% of permanent representatives to the UN that countries send have ever been women, right? And that to me really was probably the thing that stuck in my mind a lot. And we often focus on representation for global South countries or for, you know, former colonies, post-colonial countries and so on. But when you shift the lens to gender, and I assume that then when that intersects with being in the global South, it might be an even deeper problem for all kinds of historical reasons. And so it's really something that we don't think about enough. And Karen was really, it was very important that she brought that up.
It would be interesting, though, to see if that's quite the case, because like I had mentioned, the African Court of Human and People's Rights has a direct provision that there's gender equality on the bench. And actually, it lives up to that. So I do think in some places in the global South, actually, this is, you know, something that's been on the minds of people for much longer than it has been in the global north. Like, I actually believe Rwanda is actually one of the first parliaments to have gender equality or gender parity in their parliament. So again, that's why I think it's important to think about and take lessons from the global south as well, because sometimes there's, and some markers, they may be in instances doing better.
So aside from this podcast, what's next in terms of outputs from the conference?
We have plans to put together an edited volume. It'll have to go through all the steps of sort of, you know, submitting a proposal, getting peer review done, and then hopefully, you know, the reviewers will like it. So it'll be a collection of these papers that we have put together.
Well, our listeners should look out for that in due course. Just before I finish, I just wanted to give both of you the opportunity to promote any of your own work, any recent publications, books, or anything you have coming up that you think might be of interest to our listeners?
I will have a book coming out this summer with Cambridge University Press that looks at decision-making within international courts. And it focuses on courts in the global South. And it basically looks at the question of what role judicial independence has in shaping judicial decisions.
Well, I would like to promote that book, but also I recently got a grant from the British Academy to do evidence-informed policymaking. A colleague in Brazil, Dr. Matthias Spector, and I won a grant to sort of include Global South perspectives in policy planning, thinking about what kinds of instruments you can build to actually have systematic inclusion of Global South perspectives, both, you know, in Global North countries like the UK, but also in Global South countries like Brazil. And so we're kind of planning surveys and focus groups to learn more about how Brazilian publics think about changes in international order.
Well, our audience should definitely look out for those as well. Just remains for me to say thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rohan Mukherjee is Assistant Professor in the LSE's International Relations Department. Teresa Squachito is Associate Professor in the LSE's International Relations Department. During the conference, I spoke to three other participants about their thoughts on the future of democracy and global governance. Dr. Agnes Yu is an LSE Fellow in the Department of Government. Dr. Farsen Gassim is a Junior Research Fellow in Politics at the Queen's College at the University of Oxford. Professor Tim Marithi is Head of the Peacebuilding Interventions Program at the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation in Cape Town, and Extraordinary Professor of African Studies at the Center for African and Gender Studies, University of the Free State in South Africa, as well as an honorary research associate at the Institute for Democracy, Citizenship and Public Policy in Africa at the University of Cape Town. I asked each of the three participants about what their research or area of study could tell us about the future of democracy and global governance in light of the growing questions about the US-led world order.
I'm Dr. Agnes Yu. I'm a postdoctoral fellow in global politics at the LSE Department of Government. At large, I'm interested in when and why individuals protest for populations in other states. So why did South Koreans mobilize for Black Lives Matter? Why did Chileans mobilize against Russia's invasion of Ukraine? And what's really interesting about these instances of mobilization compared to conventional studies about domestic-oriented protest or transnational-oriented protest, where citizens are either protesting against their own state or collectively together protesting their states on an issue, is that you have this in-between area where individuals are protesting a state, but it's not their state, it's a state elsewhere. So why do people protest on behalf of others on issues that might not directly concern their domestic politics? And more importantly, the concessions might not even directly benefit them. So given this area of research, I think that my work speaks to at least two points about the future of democracy and global governance. The first is, who is involved in the future of democracy and global governance, and what kind of actors are we paying more attention to? Again, international-oriented protest is distinct and particularly interesting because you have individuals and publics of a different state targeting a government abroad. So you have this interesting phenomena where it goes beyond this, you know, conventional IR understanding of a boomerang effect, where in order to impact change abroad, citizens would, you know, protest their state to pressure the other state, right? But here we observe a more diagonal relationship where citizens are directly taking up demands and expressing their demands towards states elsewhere. So understanding, in terms of understanding the future of democracy, then the individual or different publics around the world, not just publics in relation to domestic protests, but thinking about how publics elsewhere can have international outcomes is very important to think about in terms of the key political actors that we should be looking out for when thinking about the extent that democracy could be consolidated, pushed forward, pushed back, et cetera, et cetera. The second, perhaps more obvious point, is that protest is going to continue to be a key form of political mobilization. It's only just kept transforming through, you know, you have domestic, transnational, and now this emerging form of international-oriented protest. Certainly, people have protested on behalf of other populations before, but we're entering this, I would say, rather unique era of hyper-interconnected informational space, right? We are able to access news and access information about conflicts very far away from our everyday lives. And we have protests that are emerging more frequently also against these issues abroad. So I would say that thinking about the future of global governance, especially, protest is going to be a continuing important cast member of that.
That was Agnes Yu of LSE's Department of Government.
I'm Farzan Yassim, Junior Research Fellow at the Queen's College in Oxford. What my research tells us and has been showing over the years is also in, you know, these times of significant changes in U.S. politics with the election of Trump, then the election of Biden, and now the re-election of Trump. Over these years, we've conducted many surveys all over the world, including the U.S. several times, but also countries in the global East, other countries in the West, in the global South, and other countries in the global North as well. And what we observe consistently in these surveys is that the citizens worldwide prefer international organizations to be designed in a more cosmopolitan way, meaning that they prefer them to be designed more democratically, with more representation by representatives who don't just represent national governments, but also citizens directly, or, you know, indirectly in other ways, such as random selection or parliamentarians, and that they also want, that people want international organizations to be designed to be more authoritative, so to have stronger implementation powers themselves, rather than power in the international sphere remaining within the hands of national government representatives. So if anything, what this research shows is that despite, in a way, the kind of public focus on, you know, developments in the U.S. and elsewhere in a nationalist authoritarian direction, actually international public attitude is quite consistently, and in majoritarian ways, you know, consistent majorities are in favor of stronger and more democratic international institutions.
That was Farzan Yassim of the University of Oxford.
Professor Tim Murithi, Institute for Justice and Reconciliation, Cape Town, and also the University of Cape Town. So some would say we are now at the end of the post-World War II order that was indeed very much led by the United States of America. And we are facing a number of multiple crises around the world. And it was the academic Antonio Gramsci who said that the nature of the crisis is that the old is dying and the new is not yet born. And in this interregnum, we have a myriad of morbid symptoms. So we're very much in the Gramscian interregnum. And democracy, it seems to be, is on the retreat, at the very least at the national level, and at the global level in terms of the liberal international order that was US-led, seems to also be under significant strain. So indeed, the old is very much crumbling and the new is struggling to be born. And we have to ask ourselves whether we can glean the emergence of what some have called the global constitutive moment. Is this moment a time when we can in fact advance the case and the cause for global constitution making to promote a democracy at a global level and establish a global democratic order? South Africa's transition in 1994 to democracy provides us with very important insights into how difficult such a process is. It's arduous, it's painstaking, but democratic transitions from very complex and contested situations, of course, we had apartheid in South Africa, can be overcome. And so if we are indeed at a global constitutive moment where we can identify a global demos or a citizen of the world collective movement towards world citizenship, we can then ascertain how transnational social political action can empower this global demos to push forward with this agenda of a global constitution-making process. And I would say, given the crisis that we're facing right now, we can draw a lot from South Africa's transition in terms of the dialogue and the negotiation, the constitution making that led to the adoption of a constitution in South Africa, and then the subsequent consolidation of democracy, which has been happening over the last 30 years. And if we transfer this analogy to the global level, we can equally identify processes that can enable us to activate global dialogue, global negotiation, and a global constitution-making process. There's a very specific pathway to achieving this through invoking Article 109 of the United Nations Charter, which calls for a general conference to review the Charter of the United Nations. This was a provision that was included in the Charter of the United Nations by the founders of the United Nations in 1945. And in the 80-year period since then, it has never really been invoked. So Article 109, I think, creates for us a very powerful platform to at least initiate the process of global dialogue and negotiation and enable us to move towards taking advantage of this globally constitutive moment and to engage in the arduous and challenging work of global constitution making going forward, which I think, from my perspective, will enable us to replace the existing liberal international order with something that is akin to a slightly more democratic system of governance at the global level.
That was Tim Murithi of the University of Cape Town. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Rohan Mukherjee, Teresa Squatrito, Agnes Yu, Farsan Gassim, and Tim Murithi for joining us on this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Centre and our work, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Luke Digweed. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at lse_us and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people to find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.
Play ball!